Hey, it's Al, and last fall, we brought you Mississippi Goddamn. It was named one of the best podcast series of 2021 by The Atlantic, CNN, Rolling Stone, and others. We told that story over the course of 7 weeks, and now we're making it available to you to binge. You can hear the whole series by subscribing to Reveal Presents Mississippi Goddamn wherever you get your podcasts. Again, that's Reveal Presents Mississippi Goddamn.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, filling in for Al Etzen. If you've been pregnant or gone with someone to an ultrasound visit, then you might recognize that sound. It can bring up a range of emotions. If you wanted to be pregnant and you've experienced that moment where you feel like you're meeting your baby for the first time, it might feel so joyful to hear that sound. Or maybe you've had a pregnancy loss and that sound is hard to hear. And if you're like me, I'll be honest, that sound just reminds me of how bummed I was that I couldn't be there in person to hear those first sounds from my baby. Whatever your experience may be, this idea of a heartbeat is so resonant in our society. I mean, consider Valentine's Day. How many other vital organs have a holiday devoted to them? So maybe it's not surprising that the anti-abortion rights movement has latched on to this image and the sound of a beating heart.
That that beautiful melody of a tiny life, innocent, vulnerable, and worthy of our protection.
That's Texas State Representative Shelby Slauson, one of the sponsors of the so-called heartbeat law. On the other side, scholars like Michelle Goodwin say the whole premise of the heartbeat law is misleading, because it's meant to conjure up an image of this undeveloped embryo as a tiny person with a heart.
It's purposeful. In many instances, it's deeply weaponized as well. But it's also part of a longstanding cultural expression, and also a commercialized one too, right?
And in Texas, it's been effective. In September, the heartbeat bill, known as Senate Bill 8, went into effect. It bans an abortion when cardiac activity can be detected during an ultrasound. Dr. Blair Cushing works at the Whole Woman's Health Clinic in McAllen, Texas. And part of her job is to deliver the life-altering news that a patient can't move forward with an abortion.
You can sort of see like this wave of emotions that crosses them of it could be sadness, it could be fear.
The signs of a developing cardiovascular system are usually detectable around 6 weeks. That's just 2 weeks after a missed period. And Dr. Cushing says that amount of time gives women very little opportunity to decide whether to keep or end a pregnancy.
I want people to understand that this law has forced so many women into making a more rushed decision than they otherwise would have.
Sometimes she gives a patient an abortion pill and then watches the patient hesitate.
At least once per session, I will have a patient in exactly that position, that she sits there and she takes the pill from me and she holds it in her hand and then just like breaks down, telling me this like extreme uncertainty that she has, but feeling pressured, like she knows if she doesn't do it now, she's going to lose her chance.
SB 8 in Texas is not the only abortion law that's reached the Supreme Court in recent months. A case out of Mississippi is a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. If the court strikes down that landmark decision, then states could start enforcing even the most extreme anti-abortion laws, which is why we're taking a deep look at the so-called heartbeat bill. It's already led to severe restrictions on abortion in Texas. Patients there have been forced to travel to more than a dozen other states, and some aren't getting their abortions at all. The question is, how did the so-called heartbeat bill succeed when so many other attempts at banning abortion early in a pregnancy have failed? For months, we've been trying to answer that question with journalist Amy Littlefield and a team of students from the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center and Investigative Reporting Program. As Amy tells us, it's a combination of savvy marketing and good timing.
In 2010, a woman named Janet Porter went to the wake of her former boss at Ohio Right to Life. Like a lot of anti-abortion rights groups, it focused on laws that made abortion harder to access instead of trying to ban it. That day, she realized life was short, and she wanted to move faster. Janet wouldn't talk to me, but in one of her books, she describes how she'd thought about banning abortion once brainwaves could be detected. In that moment, though, she settled on a heartbeat.
You know, if a heartbeat indicates life, it's the universally recognized indicator of life. And, you know, everyone gets it.
That's Janet, years after her epiphany. At this point, she's running her own organization, Faith to Action. And the heartbeat bill she comes up with would ban abortion in the state of Ohio at about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Even though Roe v. Wade said states can't ban abortion until more like 6 months, when a fetus is viable outside the womb. There's pushback, even within her own movement.
Michael Ganadakis, I serve as president of Ohio Right to Life.
Mike agrees with Janet's beliefs, but not her tactics.
We both support life from conception until natural death. I tend to believe there's different ways of advocating for life, and she tends to believe there's other ways to do it.
Mike tells me back then, the Supreme Court would not uphold a law that restrictive. And if the court struck down Janet's law, it might strike down other anti-abortion laws too.
Right idea, wrong time.
But Janet was not deterred. In fact, she went all out promoting her bill with a music video.
When they hear our hearts, they'll care. Send the message, someone's in there. Show them that we are alive. With 99 red heart balloons for life.
This is only the beginning. Later, Janet fills a press conference room with red Mylar heart balloons and sends roses and teddy bears that play heartbeat sounds to lawmakers. Mike is watching all of this happen.
I believe we had a plane with banners flying over our state house multiple times on multiple
And he's
days.
Publicly opposing the bill. The disagreement is splitting the movement in Ohio. Janet would write a chapter in her book, The Enemy Within. A good chunk of it's about Mike.
I have been on the receiving end of very blunt criticism from Janet, and, you know, it's a free country. Everyone can have an opinion.
Mike may not agree with the spectacle of it all, but he can't deny that it's helping his cause.
There is value in talking about a beating heart. I think the marketing around that, the messaging around that to people who might not have this as a top-of-mind issue was brilliant.
Janet knows how to get the media's attention.
We had a mobile ultrasound. We hooked it up there in the committee room.
Here she is on a show called The Gospel Truth, telling televangelist Andrew Womack how she brought a fetus to testify at a public hearing.
We put it up on the screen, and there you could see the baby's heart beating. You could see it. They could zoom in on it. You know, they make it red. And the pro-aborts hated it. Oh, my goodness. They were going nuts. You know, Janet and her gimmicks and her stunts and her antics.
By 2013, these stunts were getting traction outside Ohio. Versions of her bill managed to pass in North Dakota and Arkansas. But Janet just wasn't able to get enough Ohio lawmakers behind her bill to pass it. So she ran for office herself.
Janet's endorsed by Mike Huckabee, Dr. James Dobson, and Gun Owners of America.
I'm Janet Folger Porter, and I'll fight to defund Obamacare and end abortion.
Janet lost the primary by a lot. Then Donald Trump got elected, and things started to change.
Brett Kavanaugh has been confirmed to be an associate justice on the United States Supreme Court.
Within a few years, Trump had appointed two justices to the Supreme Court. A lot of people thought the court might be willing to reconsider Roe v. Wade. Even Mike Ganadakis.
It all came down to timing, and that's truly it.
Ohio Right to Life threw its support behind the bill. In 2019, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine signs it. At the signing ceremony, Mike Ganadakis is right there.
Oh, absolutely. Front row seat.
But Janet, who had burned so many bridges during her 8 years fighting for the law, she wasn't even invited. A decade after launching her so-called heartbeat bill, Janet's gone from annoying Republicans in the Ohio legislature to being welcomed as an honored guest in Texas.
As Ms. Porter made it into the chamber, I know she's an expert on this topic, and we're sure excited about having her in the state. Ms. Porter, come on in. You're in the right place.
Janet was in the right place at the right time.
This is a common sense bill. Everybody knows it. If there's a heartbeat, there's life. You know, it's why we instinctively check for a pulse if we're wondering if someone's alive or not. It's the reason why we've never been to a funeral of somebody with a beating heart.
At this same hearing, a woman who testifies tries to copy one of Janet's stunts.
My name is Misty Tate, and I'm a registered stenographer.
Misty works at a crisis pregnancy center. These are places set up to look like real abortion clinics, but they're actually run by anti-abortion rights groups. They offer free ultrasounds as a way to try to convince people seeking an abortion to change their minds.
Let's listen now to two brief recordings that I gathered from work this last week. One recording is from a baby that is protected from abortion because the fetal age is over 20 weeks. And one recording is the heartbeat from a patient, and she was 6 weeks and 2 days the day that this was recorded. That was one. When you hear these two heartbeats, can you tell the difference?
I can.
That's Dr. Lori Strakowski.
They do sound slightly different to me. The swishing sound is different in the latter.
Dr. Strakowski is a professor of radiology at University of California, San Francisco, one of the leading institutions for OBGYN training.
My specific interests are primarily in obstetric and gynecologic ultrasound.
We asked her to tell us what we're really hearing on an ultrasound at 6 weeks.
What are we hearing? When we put a stethoscope on the heart of a human that is after birth, the lub-dub sound that we are hearing are the valves of the heart. That is different. There are no valves yet developed at 6 weeks.
Instead, Dr. Strakowski says, what we're hearing on the 6-week ultrasound is the vibration of early cardiac cells that will eventually form chambers and valves. This early in a pregnancy, just 6 weeks in, the ultrasound probe is picking up the movement of those cells.
And that movement creates these waves or sound waves that are considered ultrasonic because they are above the audible range that we hear.
It's a lot to take in, but let's recap. Here's what Dr. Strakowski is saying. At 6 weeks, an embryo doesn't have a heart yet. But it is true the cardiac system is beginning to form. And so what you're hearing are all these cells vibrating. And if you were to use, say, a stethoscope instead of an ultrasound machine, you wouldn't hear a beat at all. But for anti-abortion rights groups, this romantic ultrasound moment that we've all bought into, it's a way to convince the public that at 6 weeks of pregnancy, there's a baby with a beating heart. You could hear this strategy playing out when the Texas legislature debated the Texas Heartbeat Act. Here's Representative Donna Howard trying to challenge Representative Shelby Slauson.
You're not actually hearing the sound of a heartbeat because there's not a heart beating, but you're hearing amplified version of electrical signals. Did you know that?
I fundamentally disagree with that.
Well, you know, I appreciate that you don't want to believe this and that you are disagreeing with it, but I'm talking about what the science says. And so you're telling me that the science is wrong because you don't agree with it?
What I'm telling you is that when a beating heart represents a life within a womb, we have a duty to protect that innocent unborn life.
And I appreciate, excuse me, Mr. Speaker.
Whether or not you call it a heartbeat, everyone can agree that an embryo can't survive on its own at 6 weeks of pregnancy. And like I said earlier, under Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court ruled there's a constitutional right to abortion until the fetus is viable. But what if you just move viability from around 6 months to 6 weeks? It turns out that's what the architects of the heartbeat bill are trying to do.
Benjamin Franklin once said, "Nothing is as certain as death and taxes." He left one thing out, and that is birth after a heartbeat.
That's David Forte, a former Reagan administration attorney, now a law professor in Ohio, who helped write Janet's original heartbeat bill. He's testifying in front of Congress.
The court also said that viability is when the fetus can survive on its own. But nobody can survive on its own. Everybody needs extrinsic help. What do doctors, obstetricians, say about viability? They say a viable fetus, a viable pregnancy, is one where the heart is beating and it is likely, almost inevitably, to reach full term. That's what doctors say viability is, not what judges say viability is.
Mary Ziegler is a law professor and expert on abortion law. She says Forte is playing with the semantics of the word viability, but he's also doing something else.
This is a group of people who are not entirely convinced that the Supreme Court is going to go all the way to fertilization.
In other words, a lot of anti-abortion rights activists believe life begins the moment a sperm and egg come together.
So it's to say we're going to come as close as we can to fertilization while convincing the court that they haven't done anything that radical and that what they're doing is on the side of science.
We found this is part of a wider effort by anti-abortion rights groups to pivot from religious to scientific arguments. And there's a network of anti-abortion medical experts who claim that science is on their side. One of these groups is the Charlotte Lozier Institute. They use research from legitimate scientists to help promote the idea that a heartbeat means a viable pregnancy. I called up the author of a paper cited by the Institute to check it out.
I'm Dr. Jennifer Heyer. I'm a full-scope practicing obstetrician-gynecologist.
Dr. Heyer told me that her research was conducted on people who had experienced miscarriages and were undergoing fertility treatments. She measured rates of cardiac activity to try and determine the likelihood that a pregnancy would be successful.
They want to parent children. And so are there things that we can do to make things more reassuring for them?
And yes, her study found that cardiac activity is a strong sign that a pregnancy will continue developing. But she was shocked to hear that her findings were being used to argue that people who don't want a baby should have to have one anyway.
I'm embarrassed. That's disgusting. I mean, it's true information, but they skew the truth. This is not a political decision. This is a medical decision and a personal decision for the person that is pregnant.
When she took to the floor of the Texas legislature, Representative Donna Howard did her best to get that point across.
There will always be women who will pursue having abortions despite what you do here today and what you've been doing for a decade. To create all these obstructions, it will always be a case that women will seek abortions because women are not always in a position to have that baby, and you guys don't have to have them. We do.
As she feared, the so-called heartbeat bill was passed into law. And unlike the versions that came before it, it's taken effect.
For 5.5 months, millions of Texans have been living Janet Porter's dream. How did the courts, which once struck down the so-called heartbeat bans, allow that to happen? That's next on Reveal.
Hey, 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 it's time for another Al's Podcast Pick, and this one is for Reveal listeners who speak Spanish. It's called Radio Ambulante. Every week, they tell stories from Latin America and U.S. Latinx communities. Moving, surprising, deeply reported stories about love and migration, youth culture and politics, about the big questions and the unique voices that are shaping the region today. You can find Radio Ambulante wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, in for Al Letson. We just heard how anti-abortion rights activists have used the claim that an embryo is a person with a beating heart as a marketing tool to advance so-called heartbeat bills. The bills ban abortion at around 6 weeks of pregnancy, way before what our current laws say. Under Roe v. Wade, abortion is a constitutional right up until the point that a fetus can survive outside the womb. Versions of the so-called heartbeat bill have passed into law in about a dozen states. But none of them had been allowed to take effect until Texas. And it has to do with the way the enforcement part of the law was set up. Instead of the state punishing people for performing abortions, the law was written so that any private citizen could enforce the law. And this is a pretty radical idea, but it's a big part of what has allowed the law to stand, at least for now. Reporter Amy Littlefield has been investigating how this legal strategy came about with the help of a team of law and journalism grad students at the University of California, Berkeley. It turns out it all started in the parking lot of a Chick-fil-A.
It's a gray December day in the heart of Texas, and Mark Lee Dixon is on the road again in his white Ford F-150 pickup truck.
This morning I left Chandler, Texas, and heading to Wichita Falls, Texas.
He's talking to me on the phone while he drives. Mark has been called a traveling salesman for the anti-abortion rights movement. And while he may not have realized it at first, he's been laying the groundwork for the first so-called heartbeat law to withstand legal challenges and actually go into effect.
Well, right now my truck has 246,409 miles on it.
Wow.
Mark grew up in East Texas. His grandfather ran a right-to-life group there and used to display models of fetuses at the county fair.
And I remember looking at those, thinking that I was that size at one time. And it really had a huge impact on me.
Now Mark's running his grandfather's organization. In 2019, Mark's getting worried that an anti-abortion law in Louisiana might force the clinic where he goes to protest in Shreveport to relocate to Texas. And he's come up with a plan. He'll convince Texas cities to ban abortion by declaring themselves sanctuary cities for the unborn.
I was staring at this ordinance at a Chick-fil-A in Longview, Texas.
So this ordinance he's drafted would ban abortion within the city limits of Wascom, population 2,000. Wascom sits just across the border from Louisiana. There's just one problem, Roe v. Wade, which established a constitutional right to abortion in 1973. Mark knows that these ordinances will be challenged in court and could wind up costing towns a lot of money to defend.
I was thinking about the unborn, but I was also thinking about the born as well. Those city council members, good people. I didn't want to see them sued into oblivion.
So he's at this Chick-fil-A trying to figure out how to outlaw abortion without bankrupting towns, and he gets in touch with Texas State Senator Brian Hughes. Hughes has received thousands of dollars in donations from anti-abortion groups over the years. His district includes Wascom.
And so he introduced me to a friend of his, Jonathan F. Mitchell, former Solicitor General for the state of Texas.
So they all hop on a conference call.
And us three looked at this together.
Jonathan is a powerful, well-connected attorney. He clerked for late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, worked in the administration of George W. Bush, and volunteered for Trump's transition team. Abortion isn't his only issue. He's fought unions, affirmative action, and same-sex marriage.
He said he had an idea of how to allow for this Wascom ordinance to survive a legal challenge that make it safer for the city of Wascom to pass.
This is where that strategy of private citizens enforcing abortion bans comes into play. Jonathan's idea is to write the ordinance so that the government isn't responsible for enforcing the ban. Instead, private citizens would be able to sue anyone who, quote, aids or abets an abortion. So the doctor, clinic employees, even the Lyft driver who takes someone to an abortion clinic could all be sued. And citizens would be awarded at least $2,000 in damages. It almost sounds like this ordinance would be creating a corps of abortion bounty hunters.
What happened from there is the private enforcement was added to the ordinance, and the rest is history.
Now, this is a radical idea, but also a clever one. Because if you're an abortion rights group trying to challenge the abortion ban, who do you sue? If you sue the government, city officials can say, hey, we're not enforcing this ban, so we can't be held responsible. So then that leaves groups fighting this law playing whack-a-mole with any private citizen who decides to sue. This novel strategy comes from another radical idea Jonathan has, something he calls the writ of erasure fallacy. Jonathan said he's declining all interviews because of ongoing lawsuits. But in 2018, he presents his idea at a conference of the conservative legal group, the Federalist Society.
We have a terrific lineup, five bright young legal scholars who will present.
Picture a baby-faced, clean-shaven lawyer in his early 40s. He's arguing that the courts don't really have the power people think they do. And when they strike down a law, it's a fallacy to believe the law has been erased.
Judicial review does not empower the courts to formally revoke or suspend legislation. It allows the court only to decline to enforce a statute in a case before the court, and it allows the court to enjoin the executive from enforcing that statute.
In other words, courts can only stop the state from enforcing a law. They can't erase the law from the books. This is a shocking idea, even to people at this conservative legal conference.
Let me start with Jonathan, my former student. And Jonathan always puts the fear of God in me because God forbid he should be right on this particular question.
This is legal scholar Richard Epstein, a huge rock star in conservative circles. Epstein is about to bring up a really good point. If Jonathan is right and laws struck down by the courts never really go away, then that same concept could be used to resurrect all kinds of laws. He calls them landmines.
And I think most people would say that this is an enormously dangerous type situation because what it does, in effect, is it kind of keeps the landmine alive. Jonathan, I think, is well aware of this particular problem.
Just think about it. If Jonathan is right and old laws don't go away, the laws that criminalized same-sex relationships or required racial segregation in schools or a slew of other laws that courts have overturned, those are all just on pause, waiting for the next judge to come along and hit unpause.
God forbid anybody should ever use this.
But people in Texas are actually using this. In June 2019, a city council of five white men in Wascom, Texas, approved the first Sanctuary City for the Unborn ordinance by a vote of 5-0. The ordinance calls Roe v. Wade illegitimate. But even more telling, it refers to abortion as murder, hearkening back to old Texas laws that considered abortion a crime. Laws that, Jonathan argues, are still on the books, just paused. More Texas cities would soon follow suit.
A Panola County city, Gary, declaring itself a sanctuary city for the unborn.
Many of them are tiny communities like Gary, Texas, population around 300. None of these towns has an abortion clinic. But in fall of 2020, Mark takes his ordinance to a city that does. Lubbock, Texas, is a city of just over 250,000 people. It sits several hours northwest of Dallas in a solidly red part of the state. And on the day of the hearing, in the midst of the pandemic, a lot of people turn out to testify.
So in the city of Lubbock, as we look at 277 lives lost to COVID, how many are you willing to see lost to abortion?
Designating Lubbock as a sanctuary city would protect the tiniest and most vulnerable citizens from a certain death.
I'm older than most people in this room. I've never heard of such an overreaching, ridiculous ordinance like this.
The city council members also don't like the ordinance. Council member Randy Christian tells the crowd that he abhors abortion, but he's been talking to legal scholars who warn the ordinance is unconstitutional.
Prepare for legal action to be taken against our city.
that well could cost the taxpayers hundreds and thousands of dollars.
Councilmember Latrell Joy.
I'm a lawyer licensed by the state of Texas, and I took an oath to uphold the laws of the U.S. Constitution. I think you need to understand that we cannot do what this ordinance is proposing.
Jonathan Mitchell, who's argued cases in front of the Supreme Court, has offered to represent the city pro bono if it gets sued. But it's not enough to convince the council members.
All those in favor of that motion, please say aye. All those opposed to that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion fails 7-0.
But then Mark and a group of residents rally to put the ordinance on the ballot. In May of 2021, the voters in Lubbock pass it. And it succeeds in shutting down abortions at the only clinic within hundreds of miles, Planned Parenthood. The strategy is working. By last summer, more than 30 cities have passed Mark's ordinance. Then he gets to Edinburgh, near the Mexican border.
All three members of Edinburgh City Council agreed with Mayor Molina's desire to make Edinburgh the first sanctuary city for the unborn in the Rio Grande Valley.
And I want you to know, as the mayor, and I'm only one vote, we vote as a team, but you do have my commitment that you will get this done.
Texas is known for its conservative politics, but there's a robust reproductive justice movement here led by women of color, and they spring into action.
We do have Zaina Zamora.
At a public hearing, Zaina Zamora is the first supporter of abortion rights to speak. She's executive director of Frontera Fund. The group helps people in South Texas access abortions. People often call the fund for financial or logistical help.
And over 20% of our callers were people and citizens of Edinburgh.
She's a soft-spoken woman, and she's nervous. Her teenage son is standing behind her.
These anti-abortion ordinances and the language used to describe those seeking abortion further stigmatizes and shames people for making the best decisions for themselves and their families. The decision of whether or not to become a parent is one of the most important decisions a person can make. No matter what your view is on abortion, nobody has the right to interfere with that decision.
The turnout Zaina helped organize is beyond what she was expecting. And people really bare their souls. A warning to listeners here, this next clip is about sexual violence.
I'm not here with any group. I'm here on my own. I'm a resident of Edinburgh. My dad raped me for the first 12 years of my life. And thank goodness I didn't get pregnant. But if I did, I should have the choice to abort because I would not raise my brother's son or my sister daughter.
Right now, I'm here to say that my abortion saved my life.
Conservatives like people here constantly preach about government overstepping and invalidating personal freedoms. Well, damn it, I'm here to tell you that is precisely what each and every one of you who are considering this ordinance are doing.
The testimony goes on for 3 hours. Then the city manager warns against passing the ordinance. He says he's worried about the impact it could have on the city. All of the council members back down. And Richard Molina, the mayor, who is gung-ho about banning abortion in the city, realizes it's over.
If nobody makes a motion, then that means that this dies? Counselor?
That's correct. A motion is required for the city council to take action.
Okay, so then there's no action. This item dies and we're moving on to the agenda.
That's correct.
Okay, let's move on then.
This victory feels amazing to Zaina because it's so rare.
This is my community, and my community showed up and it showed up for us, like showed up for people's abortion rights.
Zaina won this battle, but she and other abortion rights supporters are losing the war. And this is where Janet Porter's heartbeat bill comes back into the picture.
This bill will protect the lives of our most precious Texans, starting at the moment that little heart
is beating.
That's Brian Hughes, the Texas state senator who brought together Jonathan Mitchell and Mark Lee Dixon during the phone call at Chick-fil-A. They're the architects of the ordinances that use citizen enforcement to ban abortions at the local level. That's given them a roadmap to do the same at the state level. So Hughes is introducing a bill that mashes up the emotional punch of Janet's heartbeat bill with the enforcement strategy of the ordinances. And he's repeating Jonathan's radical legal theory while doing it.
The statutes protecting little babies from abortion that existed in 1973 are still alive and well.
Those laws criminalized abortion. And Hughes is saying that they could come back.
And as the Supreme Court allows us, those statutes are still very much enforceable.
The Texas six-week abortion ban, known as SB8, gets signed into law. Abortion rights groups challenge it in court. And remember, each time a so-called heartbeat bill has been challenged, it's been blocked. But Texas is overseen by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. That court is solidly conservative. One-third of active judges were appointed by Trump. And while he doesn't argue this case at the court, Jonathan Mitchell has a great track record before the Fifth Circuit. We found 19 cases that he argued there himself, and he only lost one. A few of the cases are still pending. The Fifth Circuit refuses to block SB8, and Jonathan gets his chance to defend the law at the Supreme Court. Justice Sonia Sotomayor challenges his notion that the state is not involved in this law because it's outsourced enforcement to private citizens.
Are you suggesting that states can hire agents to do unconstitutional acts?
No, they cannot hire agents.
So what's...
No.
How can the state designate a private individual
because
to act on its under its laws to violate a person's constitutional rights?
Because there's not an agency relationship here, Justice Sotomayor.
It's saying to it, you under this law, mm-hmm. our law, you can act.
But the court allows the law to remain in effect while legal challenges play out. In her most recent dissent, Sotomayor writes, "This case is a disaster for the rule of law and a grave disservice to women in Texas who have a right to control their own bodies." The court's decision to let the law stand for now has emboldened anti-abortion rights activists, including heartbeat bill creator Janet Porter. She just filed paperwork to run for Congress.
If a heartbeat is detected, the baby is protected. Soon the nation will follow.
So far, politicians in at least half a dozen states are trying to follow Texas's lead.
That was journalist Amy Littlefield. Our story was produced by Catherine Moskowski. Law and journalism grad students from the University of California, Berkeley also helped us dig through legal cases and video archives to tell this story. The first month after the six-week abortion ban went into effect, abortions in Texas dropped by 50%. But clinics in other cities, like Wichita, Kansas, are being inundated with patients from Texas. That's next on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, in for Al Letson. It's December 2021, about 6 months after Zaina Zamora and other activists beat back that so-called Sanctuary City Ordinance in Edinburg, Texas. They won the battle, but lost the war.
All right, so I just got off the call with a caller who is traveling to Wichita, Kansas from the Rio Grande Valleys.
SB 8, the heartbeat bill, is state law. Zaina's organization, Frontera Fund, is still helping people who need abortions, but now help more often means booking travel out of state.
Oh, that's a long flight, though.
Remember, the Rio Grande Valley is at the southernmost tip of Texas. Wichita, Kansas is over 800 miles north. There's no major airport here, so patients have to take at least two flights to leave the state. And that's if they have legal status. There are interior border checkpoints on roads and at airports. Zaina says if you're undocumented, travel is difficult, if not impossible.
Man, the flights are expensive.
And then there's the cost.
And this trip is going to cost us $770.21. So now I have to look for hotels.
Another $220. All in all, it takes Zaina 25 minutes and about $1,000 to book a flight and a hotel for one person.
And folks, we're on the flight deck. Welcome to 4360-72 Wichita.
There are thousands of people who are looking for help. To really understand how this Texas law is affecting abortion access, we had to leave Texas. So we sent Reveal producer Nadia Hamdan to a clinic in Wichita.
So what are we doing here today?
Today is a busy, busy clinic day, pre-holiday, which can be hit or miss in terms of busy, and we are on an absolute hit day.
The Trust Women Clinic in Wichita, Kansas, used to see maybe one or two Texas patients a month. Now, it's more like two dozen. And today, Dr. Christina Bourne is the only doctor available to see them.
I feel like we see like a lot of folks who've been driving all night, who've slept in their cars, things like that.
Over the next 10 hours, she'll see 30 patients.
We're seeing a lot more later cases because folks have to travel more, process the fact that they likely can't get care in their own state.
The fact that people in Texas are flocking to Kansas for abortion care is kind of remarkable. Yes, Kansas allows an abortion up to 22 weeks, but that doesn't mean it's some liberal bastion. In fact, this clinic was infamous.
The confessed killer of an abortion doctor in Kansas defended his actions today at his sentencing.
It was Dr. George Tiller's clinic. He was a well-known abortion rights advocate and one of the only doctors in the country to perform abortions after 25 weeks, until he was murdered in 2009. When an anti-abortion activist shot him one Sunday morning at church.
He said the killing was justified to save the lives of unborn children.
Today, though, this once infamous clinic has become an unexpected refuge.
Great, that's okay. We'll take a look at it real quick.
It's not long before Dr. Bourne gets pulled away into an exam room. It's the last time I'll get a chance to speak to her for the rest of the day. So I step out into the main room, where clinic director Ashley Brink is managing the flow of patients. She's wearing a mask that says abortion is normal, a T-shirt that says abortion is essential health care.
I mean, it's the epitome of autonomy. It's, you know, if we can't control our future, our reproductive health, then, like, we've lost. So we're just trying to keep it together and hold it together here. And
I'm sure you can hear the pop music playing in the background. It's clear the staff is doing their best to keep people's spirits up.
We are one org, but there's, you know, orgs all over the country who are kind of also holding up the abortion sky right now, and we're just a piece of that pie.
Trust Women has added six more doctors into its rotations in September to keep up with demand. That's a total of 17 doctors, and they're traveling here from all over the country. They're coming from places like California, Florida, and yes, Texas. Not a single one lives in Kansas. Clinic staff tell me doctors here have dealt with a lot of harassment. It's easier to recruit doctors who come and go.
And so this is kind of their secondary job, I guess. So they, like, travel when they can, and that's when we set up their schedule, is when they have availability. So
a surgical abortion usually takes about 3 to 5 minutes. But even so, patients are often told they'll be waiting for 6 to 8 hours. The clinics normally open until 5, but they've been closing later and later.
Yeah, just let me leave here till 8:30 on Friday.
Yeah.
And the late nights are just one thing the staff have had to get used to. There's also the gauntlet of protesters outside, the parked truck with a giant picture of a decapitated fetus, the manila envelope at the front desk with bomb threat instructions. Another example, In Kansas, the person counseling a patient about their decision to have an abortion can't be the doctor performing the procedure.
This is the room. Patients sit here. I sit here. Here's my certificate.
Clinic staffer Alexandria Parra shows me the special room for this required counseling. I can see a bunch of these certificates covering part of the wall.
And can you describe what this is, the credentials
it's just
of ministry?
A, pastor, we have to be certified like an ordained, I guess, minister.
Yes, a minister. Now, Alex and other staff could have gotten licensed in psychology or social work, but that's expensive and time-consuming. The shortest path to becoming a legal counselor is to enter the clergy. So half a dozen Trust Women staffers got themselves ordained.
Yeah, this board is starting to fill up. Both boards are starting to fill up.
By noon, the clinic's big whiteboard is filling up with surgical procedures. Another board is filling up with medication abortions. Those are the patients who are earlier in their pregnancies and aren't having surgery. Instead, they'll take some pills. I notice one patient opens her exam room door to ask how much longer she needs to wait. Another patient begins to moan as a nurse struggles to find a vein for her IV. Another is rolled out from the operating room, still drowsy from the pain meds. And new patients keep arriving. Clinic director Ashley Brink makes sure to check in on them.
Are you still doing okay in there, sweetie? Yeah. Doctor's finishing up a procedure. She'll be right in, okay? Do you need anything?
The clinic asked everyone if they wanted to share their experience with a reporter, me, during their visit. It's not really surprising that no one agrees. But I'm standing next to Ashley when I overhear that one of the patients being prepped is from Southeast Texas.
So did I see that the woman that was sitting here, she was from Texas?
Yes. So okay. She actually came in on Friday, a little bit later in the day, and based on her gestational age, we were unable to see her that same day.
Gestational age just means how far along someone is in their pregnancy. This patient is 16 weeks, early in her second trimester.
You know, we've seen some higher gestations because people are waiting, you know, have to wait 3 weeks, a month to get an appointment.
The higher gestational age means this patient now needs a different kind of surgical procedure. And while the procedure itself only takes 10 to 15 minutes, it's going to take a lot longer to prep her body.
All weekend, so we were able to get her a hotel. And so she came in and she'll get her abortion today. So, and then she'll go back to Texas.
I don't know this patient's story, but I do know that anyone from Texas sitting in this clinic has had to navigate both Texas and Kansas abortion laws. That means an ultrasound, a counseling session, a mandatory 24-hour waiting period, a second appointment with the same doctor, potentially another ultrasound, 4 to 13 hours of travel, another ultrasound, another counseling session, another 6 to 8 hours of waiting, and up to $2,400, sometimes more, just for the procedure. And that's for someone who is able to get an abortion here. A lot of people won't. The staff at Trust Women told me that about a quarter of patients never show up for their appointments.
We're doing the best we can to help as many people as possible, but I think the hardest is that we know that we can't help or save everybody, and so it's hard, yeah.
As I listen to her, Ashley's mask and T-shirt stare back at me. Abortion is normal. Abortion is essential health care.
How do you respond to, like, the opposition that tend to say the minute there's cardiac activity, according to you, for them, a heartbeat, you know, they're saying, well, that means now I'm caring for two patients instead of one?
You can believe what you want to believe, but at the end of the day, like, again, the only thing that matters to me is that the person in front of me is getting the care that they want, that they need, and that they deserve in a respectful, non-judgmental way.
Ashley says her staff will keep showing up. Keep playing music, keep holding up that sky for as long as they can.
That was Reveal's Nadia Hamdan. Right now, the Supreme Court is debating the fate of Roe v. Wade. Clinic staff in Wichita are all but sure it will be overturned. A decision is expected by this summer. Our lead producer for this week's show was Catherine Moskowski. She had help from Nadia Hamdan. Cynthia Rodriguez edited the show along with Casey Miner. Reveal's features editor Nina Martin and reporting fellow Grace Oldham collaborated with the team of law and journalism students at UC Berkeley's Human Rights Center and Investigative Reporting Program. Special thanks to Texas-based freelance reporter Mary Tuma. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Score and sound design by Jim Briggs and Fernando Arruda. They had help this week from Stephen Rascone, Catherine Steyer Martinez, and Jess Alvarenga. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Kesar Campwala. Sumi Agarwal is our editor-in-chief, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, and remember, there is always more to the story.
If you like what we do and you want to help, well, it's pretty simple. Just write us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's easy and only takes a few seconds. Just open the Apple Podcasts app on your phone, search for Reveal, then scroll down to where you see Write a Review, and there, tell them how much you love the host. Your review makes it easier for listeners to find us, and, well, it really does make a difference. And if you do it, you will get a personal thank you from me, like right now. Like, thank, wait, not him, not no, you. Yes, you. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. All right.